Well, if you want to go back to normal, get vaccinated. I think everybody's tired of meeting out here and eating outside and doing all those things you had to do last year. So it's still a personal choice, but I don't see a reason not to be vaccinated.
That was Buccaneers head coach Bruce Arians imploring his players to make their most important move this offseason: getting vaccinated. Because for Arians and coaches around the league, the COVID-19 vaccine isn't just essential for, you know, personal and public health. It's now essential for winning football games. Today, we examine the vocal minority pushing back against the NFL's new vaccination effort, and why, despite that backlash, the league remains undeterred. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Wednesday, August 4th. This is ESPN Daily, presented by UKG. Our purpose is people. Kevin, thank you for joining me, man. Where are you right now?
I am in Green Bay, Wisconsin, site of the Packers training camp.
Oh, so very boring. Nothing really going on over there, huh?
It's been uneventful for sure.
Kevin Seifert covers the NFL for ESPN and has closely monitored the league's COVID policies. So listen, the drama in Green Bay, how is it feeling right now as we're talking?
You know, it's actually died down a lot. I mean, I think people were at their most nervous and their most worried last week in the days leading up to Aaron Rodgers either deciding to retire, being traded, or reporting to camp. And when he reported to camp and was on the practice field the first day, it was very much a return to normalcy for this town and for the fan base and really for everyone around it.
So that relative calm, Kevin, what that means is that today I can pick your brain about the new drama that is enveloping the entirety of the sport you cover, because 2 weeks ago, the NFL announced these new COVID protocols for this upcoming season and the fallout from those protocols. It has been fascinating and deep and very much still ongoing. And so for those who are unfamiliar, can you just catch us all up on what these protocols actually are and how you describe the NFL's approach to combating COVID this season?
Yeah, I mean, I think the simplest way to say it is that if you're vaccinated, there are very few protocols. Very few restrictions on your actions around the team and around your personal life as well. And if you're unvaccinated, you're basically subject to all the protocols and then some additional ones that we saw in 2020. If you're vaccinated, you only need to be tested once every 14 days. You do have to wear a contact tracing device in case you get exposed, but you don't need to wear a mask. You don't really have to worry about social distancing. You can eat in the cafeteria. You can go out to dinner when you go on the road. You can leave for the bye week. You can do all the things, for the most part, that NFL players have been able to do in previous years to the pandemic. If you're unvaccinated, though, it's tough. I mean, you have daily testing. You have to wear a mask pretty much at all times unless you're participating in a game or practice. You have to stay in town during the bye week to keep getting tested to make sure that you don't bring anything into the building. When road games happen, you're going to have to travel separately. You're not going to be able to leave your hotel room, essentially. Can't eat with the players in the team cafeteria. You can't see your family without them being subject to testing. And most notably for this year, if you are unvaccinated and you trigger an outbreak on your team that forces a game to be postponed and they can't reschedule it, there could be a forfeit and your team would lose. And players from both teams would lose their game checks. So long story short, the NFL is making it very difficult for players to stay unvaccinated.
And if there is an outbreak and it's triggered by unvaccinated players, as you say, it sounds like the penalties, the blame, that all accrues the loss. That all accrues to the team with that outbreak in specific, right?
Right. But they also have pitted, I think, players against each other, because the players from the team that didn't have the outbreak, but the game was still forfeited, they don't get paid either. And so that has created an additional layer, I guess, of peer pressure, if nothing else.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of carrot and stick in this dynamic now. But I just want to be clear about this, because the league doesn't sound like it's outright saying it, but the intensity of this stuff, it appears pretty clearly designed to increase the incentives for players to get vaccinated, right? There's no ambiguity around that.
Right. And so the NFL and the NFL Players Association spent months negotiating all of these protocols. And when they ended, they very clearly said that players will not be mandated to take the vaccine. You know, it'll remain a choice. But that left a wide range of possibilities for the NFL to create incentives and pressure and make life very difficult for players who didn't get vaccinated and wanted to remain unvaccinated. And that's what we've seen play out. We've seen a sort of a maximum pressure campaign, everything short of an actual mandate.
And the effectiveness of that pressure seems to be evidenced by the fact that we're getting some pushback from players who are vaccine hesitant, as it were. And the most outspoken of all of them so far, kind of the poster boy of that response, has been Cole Beasley, the wide receiver for the Buffalo Bills. And I've been swimming in his Twitter account for what feels like weeks now. How did the Cole Beasley end of things first develop? How has that story transpired as you see it?
Yeah, I mean, he's a receiver for the Buffalo Bills and probably the most vocal of a relatively small minority of players who really, truly are against the idea of a COVID vaccine. They're not just stubborn about being told what to do. They really don't want to get a vaccine. And, you know, I hesitate to amplify some of the things he's put on social media, but suffice it to say, he's very much against the idea of a vaccine and doesn't believe in its attributes, I guess is the best way to put it. And, you know, he had a press conference the other day when training camp started.
I wanted to start this off by saying I'm not anti or pro-vax. I'm pro-choice. With that being said, the issue at hand is information is being withheld from players in order for a player to be swayed in a direction he may not be comfortable with.
He thinks he knows of a lot of younger players who he thinks are being unduly pressured to be vaccinated and said those guys don't have all the information that they need. Really, that's patently untrue, unless he's talking about misinformation. Maybe they don't have enough misinformation to not take the vaccine. And I'd be the first to criticize the NFL or the NFLPA if this was not the case, but they really have been exceptionally vigilant about providing really formal expertise and education to anyone, not just players and coaches and staff, but families as well, to provide all the accurate information needed to make an informed decision about vaccines. But this is sort of becoming his brand almost, I think.
Yes.
And what he's now released a rap song. I won't attempt to perform it, but I think the key line from that is "Ain't no vaccination for me." Don't you get it? I'm too ill to even be repaired. Ain't a vaccination for me. Only in evacuation, save him, home. And one thing I've learned covering the NFL over time is that it's, you know, while the locker room is a combination of elite athletes, it's also a pretty decent reflection of the culture at large. And so as you look at the country and you see different types of people and different types of thoughts and philosophies, you'll find examples of most of those in an NFL locker room. And I think that's played out during this entire situation.
Yeah, Kevin, it feels like Cole Beasley is pretty proudly representing the demographic of people who feel like he does, which is to say, quote, "To shut my mouth, you're going to have to kill me. If freedom of speech and freedom of choice go out the window, then there's no freedom at all," end quote, along with some other stuff that seems to be really heavy in the testicular metaphor side of the pool.
I'm sure that will appeal to the audience that he wants to appeal to, but I don't think NFL teams are very interested in hearing that side of things.
No, and look, in fairness to this category of players who are resistant to the idea of a vaccine, it's not just Cole Beasley. We've heard DeAndre Hopkins, Leonard Fournette. They've been reluctant vocally. Dak Prescott wouldn't answer the question on whether he's been vaccinated. But then there's the issue of the Washington football team's locker room, which seems to be getting pretty fraught. So catch us up on what's going on in Washington.
Right. So Washington's coach is Ron Rivera, who is a recent cancer survivor who underwent chemo and as a result is immunocompromised. And he's basically been begging players on his team to get vaccinated to protect him, if nothing else.
I'm truly frustrated. I'm beyond frustrated. And part of it is, and the reason I walked in with the mask on is, you know, I'm immune deficient. I just wish and I hope that our guys can understand that.
He, as an immunocompromised person, obviously has a higher chance of getting a severe round of COVID, even though he's vaccinated. Mm. The Washington players who have spoken about this, I mean, some of it's been borderline nonsensical. Montez Sweat said earlier in the offseason that he didn't think he needed to be treated for COVID until he got COVID.
I haven't caught COVID yet, so I don't see me treating COVID until I actually get COVID.
And so that speaks to, you know, the information that he's receiving versus the information that the teams and the NFLPA are trying to provide.
And so the good news, Kevin, that's worth saying here is that Ron Rivera's very personal plea, as you characterized it, that may have now gone through because John Keim is now reporting that the Washington football team's vaccination rate is up to 84% of the team with at least one shot, which is up from just 70% this past Saturday. And so what is especially fascinating to me in the big picture here is that if you thought the vaccine was like, I don't know, a political cause, quote unquote, it seems like NFL coaches are seeing it in a far more pragmatic football sense. And I think of what's happening in Minnesota there, where three quarterbacks are now in their COVID protocol. And that situation has absolutely exasperated Mike Zimmer, who is very much an old school kind of football guy.
Yeah, I don't know what Mike Zimmer's views on vaccination are in the larger scheme of the world, but I know that he's, because he's an NFL head coach, he's singularly focused on winning.
I'm frustrated with not just my football players that won't get vaccinated. I'm frustrated with everybody.
Some of them just won't do it. And I shouldn't say it, but some of the things they read, they're just out there.
His frustration stems from what he sees as a very easy solution to maximizing your chances to win. And in his case, it appears as though three of his quarterbacks were not vaccinated. One of them, Kellen Mond, tested positive. And as a result, two others, Kirk Cousins and their third, Stanley, were forced to become high-risk close contacts. If you're unvaccinated and you are exposed, you have to sit out 5 days. And so that's what Kirk Cousins especially is being forced to do right now. And while the Vikings don't have any games that count anytime soon, that left them with one quarterback for a practice, and they ended up having to sign two guys off the street and use coaches, assistant coaches, to throw passes to during training camp drills. And that's definitely not the way to prepare for a season. And it also brought to light, if this happened on the eve of a regular season game, you could have a repeat of what the Denver Broncos went through last year when they lost all their quarterbacks. So it's a choice by Kirk Cousins and the rest of those Vikings quarterbacks that ended up, to some degree, hurting the team.
It seems to be really cramping the style of football coaches who just want to get back to football.
Yeah, I would never, knowing Mike Zimmer over the years, I would never in a million years have imagined that he would emerge as a national advocate for vaccines.
Me neither.
But and that's not to say, like I said, I don't know what his personal view is, but when you connect it to winning and competitive advantage, he's all in. And I think all of these coaches are to a certain extent. But what's notable about him is that he's just flat out calling out people in public.
Well, it's important they're available. That's the only thing I can say about that. They have to be available. Like the quarterbacks that we tried out, they have to be available too.
Inviting reporters to go try to identify all the other players on the team because Kirk Cousins and the rest of those quarterbacks are not alone.
They have to sit outside for 30 minutes and wait for the test results. If you come in the morning, you'll see some guys sitting out there, and so they got to come in earlier because they can't be late for meetings. If they're late for meetings, they get fined.
Basically continue that pressure campaign in any way he can think possible, which will be interesting to see when Kirk Cousins and the rest of those guys come back on the roster, how that will have been received. You don't often see this kind of public bashing of a player's personal decision from head coaches.
A starting quarterback.
Yeah.
Kevin,
yeah.
Like, this isn't just like, some guy on the roster. This is the guy that is the keystone for everything you want from this season.
Right. And it makes you wonder. I mean, I don't think there's anything the Vikings want to or can do about who their starting quarterback is this year. But it makes you wonder about how the season will play out, knowing that this very dramatic and personal and intense disagreement and confrontation has emerged publicly, and we're barely into August.
All right, Kevin, after the break, I want to move from managing the optics of vaccination to how this thing is actually affecting locker rooms and how it's going to impact actual wins and losses.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each one-ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot, taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
So, Kevin, I understand the ways COVID is disrupting the sport and how the sport is trying to respond, but I want to be clear about this and fair about this as well, because vaccine rates around the league are actually good. They're really good. I mean, the league says, as of Tuesday, that 90% of players have at least one dose, which is much better than the general population. And that suggests that the vast majority of players seem to have bought into this thing, even if we don't hear as much about them. So what are you hearing from the players who have gotten vaccinated?
Yeah, I mean, they're doing it for a lot of different reasons. Obviously, there's a lot of people who are doing it for their health or the health of the people around them. But I don't think there's any doubt that some of them would not have gotten vaccinated if there was not this pressure coming from the NFL. And from the bigger picture, you could argue that that's good, that the NFL was able to create an environment where more people are deciding to get vaccinated than otherwise would. And I, again, you know, we talked about Mike Zimmer earlier. I would never have imagined that the NFL would lead the country in ways to get people vaccinated, but they have, whether it's appealing to competitive advantage, appealing to the team concept, whatever it is, they have done it. And frankly, while the NFL has made very clear that teams cannot cut players for choosing not to be vaccinated, there's a lot of players who feel like that would be the case if they did not. And that should be said, that there's definitely players who have gotten vaccinated because either they didn't think they would be signed as a free agent, or they thought that the team would find some other reason to cut them. And even if they were to be cut and they were certain that it was solely because they were unvaccinated and they filed a grievance with the NFLPA, they might get some monetary reward for that, but they're not going to get their job reinstated. That's not the way grievances work. And they would have a very difficult time having a team sign them as a free agent if they got cut, if they were unvaccinated, because again, teams would be taking on that additional risk of not having the player available. So I think that should be an important part of the discussion, whether or not it's officially mandated. There's a lot of players who have been convinced either by watching or listening to the environment that we've seen that their jobs could be in jeopardy if they did not.
Yeah, what's especially interesting to me, Kevin, about all of this is that we're seeing like old school football cliche get used in the effort of vaccination. So for instance, like the idea that the best ability is availability, that's kind of the whole ethos of what the NFL's policy has been, which leads, of course, to peer pressure and, I would imagine, interpersonal tension among players in the locker rooms at times. What's your read on how those conversations are playing out player to player, peer to peer inside the locker room?
Well, I think that part's complicated because, you know, take the instance of contracts when a player holds out, or a player becoming, quote unquote, a distraction because he's talking publicly about wanting more money. Players almost always stay out of that. You know, they almost never get involved in a player's personal business as it relates to finances. And I would imagine that I know that there's a large percentage of players who do not want to get involved in any player's decision on whether to get vaccinated or not. We've seen Cole Beasley kind of go back and forth on Twitter with Jerry Hughes, another Bills player.
And shout out to Jerry Hughes, by the way, who's just, he seems to have actually done the reading.
Yeah.
And he's just trying in public. It's better. I mean, that Twitter thread, Kevin, is in some senses better than Hard Knocks, although it is arguably more uncomfortable for the team to have to watch play out.
But I think that situation's the exception rather than the rule of how it's playing out. Now, if we get to the point where the NFL declares a game a forfeit and players from both teams, you know, lose their game checks. That could cause some significant concern and confrontation within a locker room and amongst teams. Because, again, imagine if you're the team that did everything right, you have no outbreak, you have a high vaccination rate amongst your players, and you end up winning a game by forfeit against a team that had an outbreak amongst unvaccinated players, but as a result, you don't get paid either.
Yeah, I can imagine the drama peaking as the actual regular season gets underway and all of those stakes that you mentioned become really impactful. And that makes me curious, Kevin, about your sense of how Roger Goodell, the commissioner, and his deputies in the league office, how do they feel about how the new protocols have gone over and what's going to come next in this saga?
Yeah, I think they're pretty proud that they have managed to this point within the guidelines that they negotiated with the NFLPA to have gotten their vaccination rates as high as they are. I mean, they're, as you said, they're much, much better than the country at large, especially the age group of most players, you know, in the 20s, a few in their 30s. And it also should be noted that of the other people involved in football with the 32 teams, the coaches, the staff, the personnel, medical people, equipment people, anybody who comes in contact with the football operation, the vaccination rate of those people is basically 100%. As far as what comes next, you'll probably see some evolving protocols, a lot like we saw last year as the Delta variant continues its run through the country and other unforeseen obstacles occur. They'll probably change some of the rules we've talked about. And one thing that's under discussion now is, should they increase the testing for vaccinated players to more than once every 2 weeks, in understanding that there's probably been more breakthrough infections, even if they're asymptomatic, than was originally considered when they came up with this policy. So that's the kind of thing that I think they'll continue to look at and evolve. But to this point, their major goal has largely gone very well.
Yeah. And the idea with the Delta variant, the idea there is, okay, the vaccine does not fully stop 100% transmission infection, but what it does do is incredibly effectively blunt the symptoms. So the idea being you can still transmit this thing, but you're going to have the health benefit of not having to worry about serious medical illness, even if you do have the vaccine.
Yeah, and you can be totally transactional about it and say that that makes players more likely to help you win games if they're not suffering from severe side effects. Perfect example was last year, Myles Garrett, who was this, you know, all-pro pass rusher for the Browns, had COVID and he missed a couple games. But when he came back, he had severe breathing issues. You know, he could not play a full game. You could see him on the sideline just gasping for breath, and he admitted that he needed breathing treatments for a long time. If you want to be totally transactional and just say, like, you want to avoid your best players needing breathing treatments and not being able to play full games, then that's been part of their goal as well.
You know, it feels important to keep in mind, Kevin, that the league did, I mean, look, last year there was such a degree of chaos that the league postponed or moved 15 games because of outbreaks. It was very hairy at times, but they didn't cancel any of those games.
Right.
I mean, that's part of that story too. Do you think we'll see something similar happen this year? Which is to say, do you think we're going to end up seeing one of these forfeit scenarios?
You know, if I had to guess, I would say that's a pretty unlikely scenario. I mean, they found ways to reschedule all those games last year. But I guess the contingency there would be that they did have to do it sometimes in weird situations, like play a Tuesday night game, play a Wednesday night game. And this year, they may not want to do that. Not only do the players lose money in that situation, the NFL would lose money as well if they end up having to cancel a game. And so I don't think they want to do that. I think the NFL will be highly motivated to do everything they can to find a way to play a game that needs to be at least postponed because of COVID reasons. But they certainly were very public about putting that possibility out there. And so no one will be surprised if it does happen. But, you know, the NFL is not going to get anything out of doing that and declaring a forfeit. And if I had to guess, I would say it's pretty unlikely that a game will end up being forfeited this year.
But if I had to guess, Kevin, I would bet that this is a beat that you're going to be on for a while.
Yeah, there'll be plenty to cover for not only for this season, but potentially other seasons to come.
Kevin, thank you so much for your reporting on a story that is very much still underway.
Thank you, Pablo, for having me.
All right, coming up. If you thought playing football was hard, at least it doesn't involve a literal spear.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Here's another story I want you to know. So, Sarah, the Olympics are winding down this week, and one of the final events is a sport that you know extremely well, women's heptathlon. I know very little about this. I've just gotten sort of dribs and drabs from you while doing Around the Horn with you, just feeling your general jock energy. So how far back do you and these seven events go?
So when I was in high school, my track coach kind of recognized that I seemed to be someone who might be adept at the multis, which is what we call them.
The multis,
yeah. And so he went and borrowed a javelin from a local college, and we practiced for one day so that I could go to the Junior Olympics and compete in the heptathlon. And I ended up being very adept at the javelin and the multis. And so it was sort of like a couple meets in advance of expecting to do that at the collegiate level. So I started competing in a variety of the events that are part of the heptathlon in high school, and then officially became a multi-event pentathlete, heptathlete in college.
So hold on, wait, just to rewind here real quick. So someone handed you a javelin and said, go to the Junior Olympics, and you did.
I, in fact, set a 3-state Junior Olympic record my first time competing in the javelin.
Ho!
So I have this brilliant idea. Don't you think it'd be cool if you had a gun range kind of vibe, but instead you had javelins and then various animatronic animals from like the olden times went by, so you could try to like stab a buffalo or various other animals from afar?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we do the thing where like you go and throw axes at like targets.
Right.
I feel
Why
like
don't we
this
throw
is,
spears?
We are so close to getting like heptathlon Westworld. I am all in on this. But hold on. I need to figure out what are the seven events here? Because I know these are displays of speed and agility and strength, but what are they again? What are we going to be watching these women do?
So the first day you do 100 meter hurdles, high jump, shot put, and 200. And then the second day you do long jump, javelin, and 800 meters.
That's so much. I mean, that I'm exhausted. I'm exhausted hearing you just mention that. So just like for those who are not familiar with the multis, as you call yourself and your people, the difficulty on all of this, how would you summarize and convey what that is?
Well, what I've always said, and it's become sort of this just general summation of my life, is jack of all trades, master of none. You can, of course, be a master of one of those events, or one can be particularly great for you. But if you really are amazing at one of those things, you're probably just going to do that thing, right? You're going to try to be the world record holder or the Olympic gold medalist in that one event.
Yes.
For the multis, it's the fact that you can do all of those things very well. And a lot of people might have the body type to kill it in the 800, but they're not going to be a good shot putter. They're going to be a good javelin thrower and not really excel at the hurdles. So the key is to be great at sort of all of them.
So I certainly do look up to you, given all of your experience and your stature. I would say, though, Sarah, that you may have trouble looking down at me because I also know that you've been like brutally injured because of doing this, right?
Yeah, I could never be an ultimate Frisbee. No, actually, I still could be an ultimate Frisbee champ. I've got enough working
parts.
Yeah,
I'd like to think so.
For your choice of athletic endeavor. Yeah, I tore my Achilles in college in the high jump part. When I tried to come back and do the heptathlon and pentathlon after the surgery, I started to get arthritis in my foot because I just couldn't push off anymore. Basically, they had to take a piece of my calf out and use it to restructure my Achilles because it was like an eighth the size of a normal one when they went in to fix it. So it was sort of a ticking time bomb. It was going to go at some point. For my senior year, I really just ended up focusing on the throwing events because unlike other sports, if you lose an inch or a second in track, that's the whole event, right? In basketball, you can lose a little bit of that, but still be a really great shooter or passer, or like have all those other aspects. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you lose a little in track, and that was the whole point.
And just to refresh our memories here, when we think of the heptathlon historically, like what is the name that we should be looking up to even still today?
Well, first of all, we should always be looking up to Jackie Joyner-Kersee, like the GOAT.
The GOAT.
Who is still the
time.
GOAT. I believe still has the world record in the heptathlon from like 88. And actually, interestingly, this particular combination of events has only been competed by women since the 80s. So relatively young compared to some of the other stuff. And there's actually a movement right now trying to get women into the decathlon, which is currently a men's only event. Mm. I'm glad it wasn't a movement when I was around because pole vault would have been, I'm out. Like, I would love to do it. I am not built for the pole vault.
Sarah,
and it is a game changer.
The number of videos that we could play on like highly questionable around the horn of you pole vault face planting. I do miss that hypothetical alternate universe.
Yeah, the alternate universe where like on any given day you could impale yourself, your pole could break, you could miss the pit because you timed your jump. I mean, the pole vault those pole vaulters are absolutely insane. And one of my best friends is an Olympic pole vaulter, so I can say that with personal experience that they're lunatics.
And now to the modern day, when you're on your couch, laid up, nursing your various injuries, I imagine you in some sort of body cast, although I know it's not literally that, but I know you're hurting. What's it like for you to watch this thing, knowing that inside of you is the multi that once dominated various Illinois area competitions?
Well, I appreciate you making me imagine myself. I believe it was the Naked Gun where full body cast and he rolls down a full flight of stairs at a Major League Baseball game. That is not quite me, but it feels close, Pablo. When I am watching it now, I literally think to myself that if I tried to long jump, one of my legs would fall off. Like, maybe both. It is an interesting event to watch after you've done it because in the doing of it, you're just like, yeah, this is what I do. It's not, other than the 800, I didn't find it particularly exhausting. I was ready for every event. But after you're done, within days of being done, you start watching and you're like, gosh, that looks exhausting. So at this point, I'm on the couch thinking of the glory days when my body functioned correctly and I would have been out there and feeling for them as the 800 approaches. Pablo, if you want to imagine what it would look like for me to compete in the heptathlon right now, go back to the old SNL skit with Jim Belushi, Little Chocolate Donuts. And that would both be the physique and the general vibe of me as a current day heptathlete.
Oh, Sarah Spain, our heptathlon correspondent, thank you for retiring and joining me and doing this.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.